history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you, and you might never know the incredible things they went through if you don't take the time to ask and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm confident you're going to find today's conversation with 91-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Bob Dodds pretty interesting. I caught up with Bob in Las Vegas, where he recently returned from a trip to the National World War II Memorial with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. We're going to hear about that eventually, but we'll start way earlier on his timeline. Born in Aurora, Colorado, he moved to Southern California as a young man. He jokes that maybe it was the fact that the doctor who delivered him was named Dr. Shipman, but he always had his eye on the Navy, and he even tried to sign up before he was eligible.
When I went up there, I was only 16 years old. And he said, no, you got to be 17. So I'm, well, okay, let's see. So I'm working for Taylor Electric as an electrician's helper, and one of the electricians is a ex-Navy guy. So I told him I'm thinking about going to the Navy. His good plan. Well, he liked that because that means that he could move into my position, and he had a family and everything. So anyway, he says, that's a good plan. You need me to go with you or anything? I said, no, I got this all lined out. I'm pretty good at this. So I went home and told my dad that I'd been down to see the Navy recruiter, and he says, you can't go in anyway. You're only 16. I said, yeah, but not too far away. I'm 17, Dad. And he says, no way. So you're going to college. And I said, no way. I'm not ready for college. So he said, well, whatever you want to do, I'm not signing a paper. And I know your mom and I got to sign the paper. And I said, well, okay. So I waited till 17 and I went, took the paper down, said, you got to sign this. So he says, I'm not signing it. I said, well, I'll give you till tomorrow morning. This is me talking to my dad. I'll give you till tomorrow morning or I'm leaving for New York and I'm going to join a merchant marine. He says, they ain't going to take you. And I said, they take you at 15 or 16 years old. They don't care. I guess I snowed him a little bit because he believed me, I guess. So that night, he still hadn't signed it. So I got up the next morning. I started packing my bag. Come in and said, what do you think you're doing? I said, I'm leaving. He says, why? And I said, because I'm not going to stay here. I'm not going to live off you anymore. I'm going to go do my own thing. So he says, okay, I'll sign a paper. I said, okay, let's go up to the recruiting office. So I called the chief up, and I said, we're coming up. So the chief got Dad to sign it, and 2 days later, I'm going down to the L.A. and did all the tests and everything. They weren't going to take me. They said I had flat feet. And so one of the corpsmen says, why don't you just scrunch your toes up a little bit so you show a little bit of an arch, because they walk you through a shower. So I did that. And so he took this thing back to this doctor, and he says, you know, he's got an arch there, doctor. He says, and by the way, this is Navy. It's not Army. He's not going to be marching. So the doctor says, oh, give me a habit. And he signed it. So I got in. 2 days later, I'm on the courthouse steps, and the guy that's going to swear us into the Navy was Gene Tooney. I don't know if you're familiar with Gene Tooney, but he was a boxer.
Mm-hmm.
He boxed Sharkey and several other people, but Gene Tooney, big guy. We got on the bus and went to San Diego. 3 weeks basic training, and then you get my mom and my brother come down. My dad wouldn't come down. So we went and had breakfast or lunch or something that my mom had left. And so I finished up basic training. They asked me what I want to do. I said, I just want to go to sea. I'm tired of this. I want to go to sea. So there was about eight of us, and he took us down by bus to the docks, and we got on the USS Peleus. And from there, I said, where's this ship going? They're going to eventually Pearl Harbor. And I said, oh, boy, I get to see Hawaii. This is great. It's working out fine. Just what I wanted to do. So we got to Hawaii, and everything was fine. I just had a blast over there. We got to go to Liberty, and we rented a car. But they didn't care how old you were. You could drink. And, I mean, this is living a life, you know, until December 7th.
Right, which gave you about 2 weeks of paradise, huh?
Yeah.
Before that happened. Had you graduated high school already?
Yep. Graduated 16.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, I wasn't quite five when I started school.
Uh-huh.
I was 4 years old.
What high school was that?
Hollywood High School.
Hollywood High School.
We were the Sheiks.
The Hollywood Sheiks. Remember that.
I played football up here too, by the way.
Yeah. What made you so determined to get into the Navy? Did you know a war was coming? Did you think something might be happening?
Well, no. I never thought that. I'm thinking Dr. Shipman. And that in the fifth grade, my school teacher, Mrs. Poundstone, had a boyfriend, and he was a chief quartermaster. And he used to come pick her up, and one day she had him at class talking about the Navy and everything. And he says, why don't you get this class and bring them down? He was on the USS Pennsylvania. Why don't you bring the kids down, bring them aboard on a field trip, and we'll show them around the ship. And so she says, I'll see if I can get permission to do that, which she did. So the whole class went down there. Them sailors treat us like kings. They took us down in the mess deck, and they gave us all pop and candy and all this stuff. And I thought, boy, this is the life. And they were working out, doing bench pressing stuff and doing that stuff because it's on a weekend. And so I thought, boy, this is a good life. This ain't bad. I mean, you get plenty of food. You can do workout, which I was working out a lot. And I get to go see things. So that's for me. That pretty much lined it up. And then the guy that was the Navy guy, that was the electrician, it just seemed like everything was Navy. And it appealed to me. The Army didn't appeal to me.
So you joined the Navy at 17. Mm-hmm. You head to Pearl Harbor. You've only been there 2 weeks. You're still 17 years old when December 7th rolls around. What were you doing the night before? What happened on December 6th?
I didn't get to go ashore. I had the duty. I was standing dock watch. They put you out on the dock with a rifle, and you walk up and down, chase rats going up the lines and stuff like that. It was just something to keep you busy, I guess.
And this is a sub-tender, the ship you're on, the Peleus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had two submarines alongside, the Tautog and we had all the T&G boats. That was our squadron. But everybody else, there was Tony Ballesteri and Laddie Olis and Coburn and all the bosun mates, they were in town. They got drunk as hell, and they come back, and I don't know what time. Anyway, I seen them go up the gangway, and they were being poured against the gangway, I think, because they were really had it.
Because you're up there on watch, so you see all these guys coming back from a night on the town.
Oh, yeah. So I thought, well, I'm probably glad I didn't get in there, because I'd have been in trouble anyway, you know, with the way I felt. So I didn't like being on watch that much, and it's boring. But the next morning, my job and the other kid, Lampley, our job was to go up in the gear locker and make coffee so that when these clowns got up, these bosun mates got up, they could go to the gear locker and have coffee. That was our job. I became a seaman second class at that time. So I got up early and went up on deck and made the coffee. And when I come out of the gear locker, I seen these planes coming over from the over top of the sub-base barracks and over top of us. And what the hell's going on here? Boy, they're flying pretty low. And all of a sudden, I hear a big explosion. I look across Ford Island where the battleships were, and there's a big puff of smoke, and I'm thinking, well, maybe they're just playing around or something. Then a couple more come over, and I thought, no, they're not playing around. This is serious. And they came from the east, right over the sub-base barracks, and we were close enough, the dock is close enough to say sub-base barracks, it's a three-story building, that they couldn't see us. They weren't aiming for us anyway. I mean, they were aiming for the battleships and the dry docks, which were over there. So I went down below, and I told Tony, I said, you know, Tony, you better get up. Get out of here, kid. Get out of here. And I said, okay, go to Ladiolus, the Frenchman. And I said, you better get up there because there's stuff going on up there, a lot of noise and some smoke and everything. So he said, get out of there too. So Lampley gets up, and he said, what's going on? And I said, I don't know. So anyway, I finally went and I shook the bunk, and I figured, well, Tony, you got to get up. And I shook his bunk, and he jumped up out of there, and I run up the ladder so he couldn't catch me. And he chased me up there, and when he got up the top of the ladder, he says, holy shit. And here comes Latiolus up there, and they're all drunk in their skivvies and everything. And, wow, so they went and somebody had sounded general quarters. They got an alarm that they sound. That was back on the quarterdeck someplace. So they sent me back there, tell the officer deck. So I go back there, and the officer deck got a 45, and he shoot a 45 at these planes. And they finally got all the ammunition lockers open, and we got 2 3-inch guns and forward and I think 2 aft. I can't remember. We got a 5-inch aft. I remember they were just 3-inch guns. They never fired them.
Mm-hmm.
While I was on there, and we never fired them.
Had never had a reason to.
No, not even for target practice. I mean, you'd think after that, every place you went, you had target practice. If you just shoot the guns at nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that we got the ammunition out, got the guns going, there were still a few planes, and we shot a little bit and fired some 50 calibers that were up on the King Post of 50 caliber machine guns. And they made one strafing run at us, and all they hit was, there were some hit the submarines alongside, but a couple of them hit the the captain's gig in the deck of the boat. Other than that, we had no damage at all.
Here, you don't expect an attack. You guys on your ship don't even believe you that it's happening.
Nope.
But here you are with all these Japanese airplanes coming over. What went through your mind as a 17-year-old in a situation like that? I mean, were you scared? Were you panicking? Were you trying to figure out something to do?
I was figuring out something to do, and then I thought I made a big mistake joining the Navy. This is a big mistake. In other words, I also was looking, well, what can I do? I can't get these guys up. What am I going to do? I just didn't know, because I hadn't been in long enough to figure out what all this Navy had. Navy hadn't really figured out a lot of stuff. When you go through basic training, all they're really teaching is Navy rigs and how to conduct yourself and stuff like that.
And did it seem like this lasted for a long, long time, or was it over in a flash?
To me, it lasted a long time. It really wasn't that long, but to me, it seemed like a long time. And then after that, we had gun watches. We were on the guns 24 hours a day, on them 3-inch guns, because they weren't sure what was... Nobody knew what was happening.
Yeah, who knows if there's an invasion coming.
They've actually figured that.
Right.
And they figured there would be an invasion. In fact, they issued us helmets and rifles and ammunition belts. They didn't give us any ammunition, but they gave us a belt.
When did you grasp the magnitude of the damage there?
Okay, I was hoping we didn't go there, but the next day, next 3-4 days, we put the motor launches and whaleboats in the water along with other ships, and the harbor was completely coated with black oil. The whole harbor was full of oil. And those days, the only thing we had was sand. We had sand dumped in the boat and straw, bales of straw. And what we were doing was taking the sand and scattering it, trying to get the oil to sink, and the straw would pick up some and with pitchforks like and put it back in the boat. Doing this, every once in a while when you'd take something and pick up that straw, you'd pick up an arm or a leg or one time a head. We picked up a head. Mm. And so we didn't know. We put them in the boat and asked somebody, what do we do with these? And they said, well, take them down to the receiving station, which is east of where the battleships were. Just drop them off there. And we had no place to unload the straw, so we didn't know what to do with the straw. It was all full of oil and everything. So we'd ask somebody, where do you put the straw? So finally they said, well, take it over by the Coast Guard base. It's on the channel going out, and drop it off there, which we did. And that went on for 3 days. And that was the worst part of the whole deal. I look back on it now, and I don't know how come we did that. How could we do that? But we did it. Not knowing what the heck, if there were going to be an invasion. Here we are out there with pitchforks and a boat picking up straw. What if they start landing troops or something? So, you know, all kinds of things run through your mind. And then getting back to the ship, you've got oil all over your clothes, and you have to buy your own clothes.
Right. And, you know, I don't want to take you anywhere you don't want to go. And I realize this is not easy to talk about, even though it's been almost 75 years now. But you're a 17-year-old.
Yep.
And you're picking up parts of your fellow sailors who just got killed. Is there anything that prepares you for that? How do you cope with a situation like that?
You don't. I mean, I don't think there's any classes you can take to prepare you for that. I don't know. Maybe even if you're going to medical school, you don't look at that. And then the guys that were left aboard ship, nobody's even trying to get them out.
Mm. And guys trapped in the Oklahoma at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're hearing pings on the wall, bulkheads. And it all comes down to the fact that a lot of the sailors, the guys that are older, blamed Admiral Kimmel for a lot of this. What was happening this particular weekend, all the voids were open on all the ships, and they were going to be a big inspection of the fleet that was in Pearl Harbor, the readiness of the fleet.
Right.
And checking all the voids and all of ammunition storerooms, and everything was open. Now, if everything had been closed, let's say the voids were closed, the ship was sealed off, ready for battle, those battleships would not have sunk. Hmm. They would not have sunk. There's actually two hulls on a battleship.
Right.
And I was on the Iowa, so I know a lot about battleships. But everything was open for an inspection, a fleet inspection, and all this is going on when they know in Washington that something, they're arguing with the Japanese about something and pushing them in a corner. The Japanese had nowhere to go except do what they were going to do.
Right. It's only a matter of timing.
Exactly.
Well, and speaking of timing, we're up against our first commercial break. When we come back, we're going to hear about the difficult duty Bob had in the days that followed the bombing of Pearl Harbor and how, after being transferred to a destroyer, he had to survive overnight floating in the water when his ship was sunk off Guadalcanal.
Check out the photos and videos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.